everyone. Welcome back to the Queens of Social Work podcast. I'm your co-host, Queen P.
And I'm your co-host, Queen H.
We invite you all to join us this week as we share, laugh, cry, and learn through our experiences as women of color who happen to be social workers.
So for some of you who don't know, there is a diagram that is often associated with domestic violence. And that diagram is called the power and control wheel. In different settings, there'll be different types of wheels, but now we're going to talk a little bit about what items are actually on that power and control wheel. And it'll help to describe the dynamics of domestic violence. Sometimes you'll hear that domestic violence is a pattern of behaviors, a pattern of manipulations, coercions, and threats. And so we're going to break down what that looks like. So Queen H?
Okay, so there's intimidation, making her or him afraid by using looks, actions, and gestures, smashing things, destroying property, abusing pets, displaying weapons.
Emotional abuse, putting them down, making them feel bad about themselves, calling them names, making them think that they're crazy, playing mind games, humiliating them, making them feel guilty about certain things.
Isolation, controlling what he or she does, who they see, who they talk to, what they read, where they go, limiting their outside involvement and using jealousy to justify action.
Minimizing, denying, and blaming, making light of the abuse and not taking their concerns about it seriously, saying the abuse didn't really happen, shifting responsibility for the abusive behavior, and saying that they caused it.
Using children, making them feel guilty about the children, using the children to relay messages, using visitation to harass the victim, threatening to take the children away.
Economic abuse, preventing them from getting or keeping a job, making them ask for money, giving them an allowance, taking their money, not letting them know about or have access to family income.
And then there's male privilege, treating her, and this is specific, right? But we can say there may be this in male-on-male relationship. So it just depends, right? So treating, or female-on-female, exactly. Treating her or him like a servant, making all the big decisions, acting like the master of the castle, being the one to define the men's and women's roles, or the just the roles in the relationship.
And lastly, coercion and threats, making and or carrying out threats to do something to hurt them, threatening to leave them, threatening to commit suicide or report them to welfare or social services if they're involved, making them drop charges, making them do illegal things.
And so we have to understand that, you know, sometimes this is not apparent in the beginning. So because people are like, oh, if this person is doing this, just leave. What happens is it's almost like a grooming. You know, they're nice and they're sweet. Then,
oh, yes.
You're walking on eggshells, you know, to say like there's a tension that comes up, right? There's, you know, aggression. There may be name calling, whatever the situation may be. And then there's an explosive episode. And then come back around. The person is nice and sweet. They apologize. They buy flowers. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll never do this again. And boom, and then you're in a cycle, right? Because it happens again. And then again, and for some people, it never rises to the occasion or the escalation of physical. It may be purely emotional or verbal abuse. But what happens is that there's an explosive episode that the verbal abuse is terrible. You're stupid. You're a prostitute. You're this. You're, you know, whatever kind of name calling and kind of degradation that they can do to the person to break them down. So now, you know, their self-esteem is so low. They think they can't do anything right, or they cause this violence against them.
And they never do. If you or someone you know is in a violent relationship, even if it's not physically violent, it can be spiritually violent, emotionally, like Queen H said, mentally, verbally. If you or someone you know is in a violent relationship, it's never, ever your fault, their fault. ever. There is this isolation piece that we talked about, where this abuser is being nice and sweet and kind and buying you things and taking you on trips. And at the same time, telling you things like, oh, your mother went to work when you were little. She don't love you. She left you in the house by yourself. Oh, your sister used your mini skirt to go to the party. Oh my goodness. She can't love you. She's the worst thing ever. So now there's something wrong with all the people in your life who you're close to. And you start to say, yeah, I did feel bad about that. Yes, that did make me upset. And the more that they're getting into your head telling you these people don't care for you, they don't love you, no one will love you like this person, nobody will treat you like I treat you, nobody will take you on these trips and all these things like I do, nobody will do for you what I can do. Now you start feeling like, you're right, they got me. They got money to take care of me. They got resources, access, whatever. They're the best I've ever had at whatever. So let me come over here and you know, draw away from people who I've been close to in the past. Let me rely solely on this person because I trust them. Mm-hmm. I value them. They've shown me that they can take care of me in certain mm-hmm. ways and meet certain needs. And this is one of the reasons, Queen H, that people do not just walk out of domestic violence relationships. Mm-hmm. There are needs that are being met.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, sometimes this is their only way to survive. So people stay in these types of environments, unfortunately, because sometimes there is no other choice for them in that moment. At least they think there's not.
So we have a treat for you all today. Queen S is a New York State licensed social worker holding a master's degree in social work from the Silverman School of Social Work, CUNY. Shout out to y'all. And a certificate from Columbia University's School of Business Developing Leaders Program for Nonprofit Professionals. She has over 10 years experience in the field of social work, supporting survivors of trauma through an anti-racist and anti-oppression lens. Queen S is an expert in training development and facilitation, curriculum design, and career development coaching, all grounded in an understanding of the network of social supports provided by New York City for people who've experienced homelessness, poverty, and other trauma. She has a passion for empowerment, adult education, and social justice, which is driven by a zeal to support individuals in helping themselves. So welcome, Queen S. Thank you for being here.
Thank Yay. You so much. I'm so happy to be here today.
We're happy to have you. So how did you and Queen H meet? What's the situation?
It feels like a lifetime ago at this point. Wow, maybe like 12 years ago.
Yeah.
We were in social work school together. We were in grad school together. And it really does feel like a world away, given all the things we've experienced, you know, personal, professional growth, just like time, and then a whole pandemic, which we're still in the middle of. But yeah, we were there at the Silverman School of Social Work, learning how to be baby social workers.
That's it. Bomb social workers. That's it. We learned to be bomb social workers. Social workers. That's it.
This is also true. This is also true.
Yes, I remember Queen S in class, and I would just be looking at her in class. I'm like, she sounds so smart. I'm like, I just loved when she answered questions because I'm like, I don't even sound like that. I'm like, she's reading all these books. Go ahead, girl.
I was reading a lot of the books. I mean, I don't know that I was caring much about my self-care, but I was definitely up very, very late reading mm-hmm. many, many books, many articles. Social work school is no joke.
People don't even know. So Queen S, we're talking about domestic violence. Can you tell us what domestic violence is? What types of violence are there and who does it affect?
Okay, well, domestic violence is just a representation of violence perpetrated by some partner, close relation. And who does it affect? I mean, it affects more people than you would consider, right? Some people would think that domestic violence is just about women, and it's really not. I think, you know, when I first started working in domestic violence in 2009, I was struck and had a bit of a kind of like a worldview crisis around the fact that I could walk around the corner and be a survivor of domestic violence. And it shaped a lot of who I am today and why and how I do this work. No one is safe from this. So I feel like because of that, we should all care and do our part to fight it and, you know, make it so that we're all living lives in which we can be free from the possibility of domestic violence.
You know, there's so many stereotypes because for so long, people only view domestic violence as a woman thing. It only happens to women. But being in the field, we know that it's an everybody thing. It happens to men, women, and children because children are affected by the violence in a relationship. And people only see it as, oh, well, this person has an anger problem. This is why they're behaving this way. But it is a cycle of power and control. They want power over the person. So they'll do anything or go about any route to get or seek power over this person so that they can control them, be it financially, physically, sexually, you know, mentally. They're ready to tear everything down so that they can feel empowered, you know, in that way. And so I can't imagine some of the things that you have seen.
Well, yeah, it's as devastating as one could imagine and probably worse. And the stories kind of run the gamut. Different types of abuse. You can have financial, as you mentioned, you know, economic, educational abuse. You can have emotional abuse. You can have physical abuse. You can have psychological abuse. So many different types and combinations of, but I think at the end of the day, what you see is a person made to feel very, very small and without the resources to free themselves from a veritable prison. And it takes a lot of ingenuity and creativity and risk-taking to pull yourself out of that space in an attempt to kind of secure safety for yourselves and possibly also your family.
But in addition to the abuser trying to get power and control, they also want to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone attempts to flee who's in a domestic violence relationship, it is so dangerous. That very, very first attempt, because there's a chance and possibility they may get away. And now that abuser has no one to abuse, no one to wield power and control over, and that's risky business, you know? So I just wanted to add that little tidbit about the maintaining of the power and control, because that's why domestic violence is a cycle and is perpetuated for how much time can we say?
Well, you take someone an average of trying to leave seven times.
That's
seven
correct.
Times. In order to stay away from an abuser. And it's not for lack of trying. I've seen abusers try their best to find and destabilize any type of assistance or support that a survivor has had. You know, putting eyes out on the street to see, you know, after visitation, where did this person go? What train were they on? What neighborhood were they on? To the point that, you know, you leave your domestic violence shelter, which is a confidential location, and somebody's people are there on the corner waiting for you to pass by. I mean, like, it's very, very challenging. And there are other things that keep people stuck in that cycle, right? Like, the reason why people don't leave is because of a fear of them being made further unsafe outside of the space that their abuser inhabits, right? And oftentimes it has to do with a person who is a survivor thinking about, how am I going to support myself financially when I leave? Am I going to have a safe place to stay? If the choice is an abuser's home or the streets, that's not a choice.
Right.
So I think we have to consider this like false dichotomy of choice when it comes to survivors, because they're really thinking about survival on a lot of different levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, you can think, I can survive the abuse that this person is giving me, but I don't know what to expect, you know, with respect to what's outside that door. And services are not such that you can just depend on them seamlessly supporting you and helping you to like take the steps you need to take to move forward with creating a safe life for yourself. Like, you're still subject to the vicissitudes of the system when you decide to leave that abuser's home. So what do you do with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even if you think about, if you have a resource, like say a family member you can go to, now you're worried that this person is going to follow you there, because you've seen so many stories where the person come and kill up the whole family. And you're like, what's happening here? So it's like, you know, I rather stay here because I know what I'm dealing with here versus go there, because then also I don't want it to leak out into everybody else. I want to keep everyone safe. And it's like, nobody's safe when you're here. Nobody's safe regardless, right? So you have to make the best decision for you.
Yes. And it often feels like you're the only one who then cares about your own safety, like, because you can't put the burden of your safety on other people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people don't want to take on the burden of your safety. That's mm-hmm. like a whole thing. And sometimes the abuser has already done work to make sure that you have nowhere to turn. I think that that happens more often than anything else, where there is calculated work done as part of this whole, like, disempowering the survivor and empowering themselves and, you know, taking and owning the power. So much work has already gone into isolating you from friends, from family, from everyone, that when it's time for you to decide that you have to leave, there's no other choice, you don't have a choice of where to go.
Do you think there are disparities in reporting violence to the authorities? Why or why not?
So there are definitely disparities in reporting. And I think that it relates to all the ways that people identify, right? So we're all familiar with intersectionality and how lots of different ways that you identify cross sections, and can either way, they end up impacting the way you experience the world around you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're considering the different lenses that come along with your gender identity, your ethnicity, your culture, your nationality, and all of the socialization that that entails, there are going to be different ways that you are socialized to perceive violence and abuse that you experience, right? And I see it in so many different ways that it just ends up determining whether you feel like this abuse or violence warrants reporting, whether you can trust who you're reporting it to. Mm-hmm. Real talk. Are the people that you're going to report it to going to help you or further put you and your family at risk? It's a real consideration when you're dealing with systems that can often feel as equally oppressive as the abusive situation that you're in. So I think all of that goes into the decision-making around whether or not someone reports to authorities or not, you know, connects with the domestic violence hotline or not, is even willing to risk the experience of going into shelter, right? Because that can seem like a whole hurdle to overcome that people are unwilling to try, because it seems like anything would be better than the uncertainty of that.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey, where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
Yeah, I can understand that, because even working in medical social work, you come across many cases. And one in particular that I'm thinking about, it was a young Latino male. And he was coming because he's, you know, having an issue with alcohol. And when you get down to the bottom of it, his wife was using his immigration status to control him. And she was physically aggressive with him. And so at the time, my intern was working with this case, and she's a young white woman, sweet though, but she was very aware of the lens that she's coming through. And she was able to really talk to him, and he finally agreed. He actually agreed to report it. And when we called the police to report it, they were two white males, and they were like, come on, you're a guy. This woman, you're letting this woman do this, like the way that they respond. And she literally told them off because it's like, he's a victim. So now why would he report? He's already worried about his immigration status. There's already the fact that he's a male and a female is doing this to him, right? And so many other and going on with that. And so who you're reporting to is very important in how they respond, right? Because if they're not there supporting you 100%, because they don't have to look like you for you to report to them, but they have to be able to have compassion for you. And what it seems though is for people, their experience is that people who don't look like them do not have the same compassion for them.
It's definitely a barrier. And it's not that reporting to the police should inherently be difficult, because it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. In a world in which officers of the law are trained to understand the nuance of the issues that they are often called to address, they need to understand. I mean, listen, very early on, I would say maybe, 4 years into working professionally, I found myself at a very interesting crossroads where I struggled with this idea that as a clinician, I was supposed to be like this observer of the client's process, in which I like didn't identify myself. I was supposed to sit back and listen and like help them figure out what their issues were, or what like the crux of their issues were, to kind of develop solutions around that. Mm-hmm. And it was right around the time that I was struggling with the ways that the clients I was serving were processing things around their identity that I was like, oh, wait, hold up. Like, I'm a whole person too. I'm supposed to be here holding their personhood on a pedestal and honestly, like not paying attention to mine, which is so interesting because in social work school 12 years ago, they were like, human behavior and human behavior in the social context and who you are as a person is shaped by all of your experience, by your trauma, by your context, by your identities, how you see yourself. And there's never a question of then how you integrate that for yourself in the service of others. And what I found is that when there's not a focus on that, all you have is your power, right? All you have is the power over someone else in that situation. Like that's what's left in that vacuum. And it's very, very problematic. And I think that the challenge with police officers, honestly, is that they're stuck in a space where in the vacuum of who they are as individuals, the fact that they could be victims too, all that they have in that space is the power that they hold over other people. And that becomes very, very problematic. And it's represented in how they then address these issues where like guns aren't in play and they're just dealing with human people and they like forget what the human context is. Once I realized that, I think the next day I woke up and it was like a whole new world for me. I was like, oh, I'm supposed to show up as my whole self. That is actually the thing that is going to help me not provide a service. Like provide a service, like what are we, I don't know. I'm not working in retail anymore. I'm not working in food service anymore. Like the work that we're doing as social workers should be deeper. We should be fighting for justice, and justice, the core of fighting for justice is that you recognize that you are not immune to the issue you are fighting for. Like, so we're not fighting for someone else. We're fighting for us yes. together, right? It's a very, very powerful thing. And I think it's a thing that many people in power or people who hold power forget. And then it leaves them to say ridiculous things like those police officers said to your client.
And I feel like that in itself is domestic violence. Listen, this man just got beat up and now you wielded your power. And so he's being victimized twice.
Exactly. So much of this work is just figuring out how you cannot have a hand in harming other people, right? That is the work. How do we all hold ourselves accountable to making sure that we're not creating another cycle of violence between us and another person?
And that's integrity, to be honest. And a lot of people lack integrity. I'm sorry, but that's a whole nother subject. In your practice as a social worker, do you consciously think about the intersection of who you are, which you did say, and what your role being gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera, plays in your work with the population you serve? And then the other follow-up question to that is, when considering that, how do you identify culturally?
I would say that initially, I didn't think about it, but everyone felt the need to remind me. There are stories I could tell you about organizations that were looking for a person of color to like lend their gravitas and street cred to the work. But then staff members would routinely, from my back, when I had like long flowing sister locks, routinely walk into rooms where I was and assume that I was a client. So this kind of like set me on a journey to figuring out what the heck was going on there and thinking about it from a bunch of different angles. Like, one, would there be anything wrong with me being a client? What does that say about me if I can't see myself where the client is sitting as a social worker? That's where I went first. Second, where I went is, oh, at this organization doing all this great work, racism can still live here? Good to know. And then I think, you know, more to this point of, you know, fighting for justice and not thinking just about service provision, because service provision is so much about how you're using your power in service of others, not about how we're fighting to make sure that we're all safe from bad things, right? So I think as people working in this field, we are not blank slates. We are bringing all of ourselves to this work. We are people too. And I think that if you are a human being trying to help other human beings work out these more challenging dynamics when it comes to abuse and violence and trauma, if you're not bringing your whole self, something will be lacking in how you're able to connect to the point of being effective in the service of others. So I think in order to see people, you have to be able to see yourself. And they're looking. My experience, and maybe it's just because I'm working in economic empowerment with lots of other brown and black women, I feel like whenever I'm working with them, they're looking for me to contextualize who I am. They're looking for the, what are you? Who are you? Why are you? Why do you talk like that? Why do you look like this? Why is your hair like that? Why are you wearing these earrings? Like, why do you look professional on the bottom but not professional on the top? I don't know. So like, people are trying to figure out the why of you. And sometimes these barriers that we try to put in place to like maintain this objective professionality doesn't serve that purpose, right? So I think you do have to come with yourself. And now I teach trainings where I talk about being a service provider within the context of who you are as a whole person. And we start off with this exercise where like you identify what your gender identity is, what your religious identity is, what your cultural identity is, what your, you know, your sexual identity is. And there have been so many times in that class where like I've revealed parts of myself that these clients who have worked with me before like never knew, as an opportunity for them to understand that like that's the work. You have to be able to acknowledge who you are in order to see other people and for other people to feel like they can be seen. So many experiences of sharing like, oh, I'm African-American and I'm Latina in rooms with other people as a person who presents as Black, like they weren't super comfortable also acknowledging that they had different cultures aside from their Blackness, right? Or revealing like sexual identity or like openness around like who it's okay to love and who it's okay to be attracted to, and other people being like, oh yeah, like I didn't know if it was okay for me to be all of myself in spaces, but because you've decided to be all of yourself in this space, that makes it okay, right? So I feel like it's super important to acknowledge all the pieces of you when you're working with other people, because that is what is going to make it okay for them to acknowledge all the pieces of them. And that is healing. That is healing. So I will go into spaces and I'll be like, I'm African American and I'm Latina and all the things, and I'm a millennial, and maybe I have like boomer mentalities and whatever, but also I am very like scarily progressive and will walk into spaces where people are like, oh, you know, it's just, you know, a matter of fact that we have power. And I'm like, oh no, but that's white supremacy. Like, these things are not above reproach anymore. They're not above question. And all of the experiences I've had in my life have led me to a point where I can identify and question those things. And I feel like once you do that, you have a responsibility to bring your whole self to a space in which other people can begin to do the same exact thing.
I love the idea of showing up as your whole self. You know, we had an episode previously that aired about old school versus new school, and old school kind of training you up in the way of just be that observer. Don't give too much. Just be, you know, be present, do no harm, and make sure you're available, fully available to then guide your patient, support your patient, your client, take them to a place of understanding so that they can do the work and recognize the importance of them doing their work and just kind of facilitating that. And so your idea about just showing up wholly and all of the things that could, that you bring to the table, you know, and what healing is and what healing looks like for yourself, for your clients and people you serve. That's just really phenomenal. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So in the past 25 years, there's been a push across several Caribbean nations to address and eradicate domestic violence. When dealing with clients who identify as Caribbean, how do you find that they process or address their experience?
The Caribbean experience is like, it's so vast, but I've definitely seen clients from Caribbean nations like sussing out the challenges of this contradicting experience of culturally accepted and sanctioned perception of violence and abuse, and them also knowing that the violence and abuse did not feel good. You know, as humans, we touch things that are hot, and the immediate thing you do is you move your hand away. So even with the challenge of a person, because of survival, like becoming numb to this experience of abuse and violence, I think that what I've seen across the board, regardless of ethnicity or nationality, is that there is something that happens where there's a turning point and the abuse and the violence becomes so risky to someone's survival that they're forced to look for remedy elsewhere. And the socialized understanding and acceptability of the violence and abuse aside, what is clear is that this may kill me, so I have to leave, or this may endanger my children, so I have to go, right? There's a switch that's turned on when it's like, regardless of whatever the perception of this is, the view of this is, I have to go because I know that ultimately it's going to result in me being seriously harmed beyond the point of return, or someone I love being seriously harmed beyond the point of return. And that's not something that I can suffer.
I think, like you said, for anyone, there's that pivotal moment. But I think really depending on where you're from would also affects or influences how you respond to this dynamic, especially in the experience of working with several people who have been in these volatile relationships. And you kind of start to see a trend of who and maybe why they stay or why they don't stay, and the resources. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why it's so important how there's so many different community organizations based on cultural or ethnicity experience, because sometimes there's a certain understanding with what is a custom from that region or that area. And yes. So getting help from this person, they can even help talk to the person about ways to be safe versus, you know, maybe me and you who are not from that area and mm-hmm. understand the dynamic of that, you know?
Right. At the end of the day, so much of this work is a sales pitch, and you have to be able to understand the context. Like, someone coming from a different country is not necessarily going to be great at sales in the United mm-hmm. States. And someone from a different state in the United States is not necessarily going to be great at sales in New York mm-hmm. City. And like, you're having a deep understanding of someone's cultural and social context is going to be key to whether you're able to give them the information in such a way that's going to make them think and believe that they can make that jump from living amidst violence and abuse or running from it. Because at that point, it's not even about being safe, because there are lots of situations that I've seen when people have, they're running, and they're running even while they're in shelter, and they're running and they're running and they're running. And for a long time, they can never stop running. Like, that's the reality. And without the context and understanding of how the resources are even available to somebody who wants to run, you're not going to be able to explain to someone how they can possibly keep themselves safe as they're running. Because again, nothing is certain. Mm-hmm. The immigrant experience in and of itself is a traumatic experience. And I think especially with immigrants for whom English is like maybe one of a first language, there is something lost, no pun intended, but there is something lost in translation for individuals who are then receiving those survivors, because they're like, but you speak English, so you must know how to navigate this. And it's like, no, things are crazy here. Like, this is weird. Like, nobody comes up from another place knowing how to manage this system and its bureaucracy and its experience of power and control and oppression that it has on people. It's really, really challenging. And I think that it stands in the way then of those survivors getting services, because they're like, if this is how the resources are being handed out, I don't know that I can deal with this. How many times have I heard it in shelter where they're like, I left my abusive situation to get free, and then what I found was more prison.
Mm-hmm. I think we've all heard that. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people end up declining to even do that. And so it's really hard as the provider, because you know that they need help, but you also know the barriers to the services. Let's just talk about resources really quickly, because there are a lot out there. But I think, you know, for me, I'm always a one-stop shop kind of girl, like where you can get a lot of different things. And so I always found the Family Justice Center is great, because the Family Justice Center has so many different organizations within it. And, you know, you can refer a client there, and they won't just be Safe Horizon. They could be Sanctuary mm-hmm. for Families. There's so many different organizations that they can hook up to get help. Since the Family Justice Centers are at the courts, you can get your order of protection. You know, the DA's office sometimes is right there. So there's so many things and so many resources right there. So there is a Family Justice Center in every borough.
I will definitely highlight what you've offered. The Family Justice Center, that's the place to go. If you want services in person, and maybe you don't even know what services you want, you go in, they screen you. And based on how you answer those questions, mm-hmm. they have a sense of what organizations you should be connected to. And we're talking clinical, we're talking legal, we're talking children, you know, we're talking all of the things, we're talking mm-hmm. economic empowerment, just like, you know, the whole smorgasbord, mm-hmm. like, anything you want, you can get there. And the proximity to the DA's office is also high key amazing, because you don't have to travel far mm-hmm. to get that order of protection. You don't have to travel far to get information about, you know, custody yep. even. I mean, a survivor will be well served by going to the Family Justice Center in their borough.
Absolutely. And if you're unsure, you also have the domestic violence hotline, which is also an oldie but goodie. And just in case anyone needs that number, we're going to have it in the show notes. But I'll tell you here, it's 1-800-621-HOPE. 1-800-621-HOPE. And for those people that don't know the numbers on the phone, it's 1-800-621-4673.
I also want to bring some attention to the Violence Intervention Program. The website is VIP Mujeres for our Latinx pop. We also have Turning Point for Muslim women. And there is also for women locate and men and anyone who have had this experience, there is a website called hotpeachpages.net. They have resources throughout the Caribbean, St. Croix, Vincent, Grenada. Anyone there who needs support, feel free to check out our show notes and you'll be able to get the website again there.
Well, thank you so much, Queen S, for being on the show and imparting your wisdom. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It's not a happy topic, but I think definitely one that needs to be uplifted so that people can figure out how to help get themselves free. And that's always good work.
You never know who's listening or who may need to hear this word. Because many a times, you know, Queen P can tell you, we've done programming, you know, where we work and people have come up to us and like, you know, this is what's going on in my life right now. And it's like, wow. So having these kind of programs and having information out there can really help the person or someone they know. And so that's, you know, so important to raise awareness of this. And the fact that this, I want to call it a disease, affects not just women. It affects men and it affects the family as a whole. And so that's an aspect we didn't talk about, but we will talk about that too, because that's important, because we need to talk about how domestic violence affects the children.
There's so much information. I mean, obviously we can only capture so much, but we will take the time to you know, have another conversation, because there's so much more that we haven't said. So we'll get to it.
Thank you guys for listening. If you guys want to connect with us on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at the Queens of Social Work Pod or on Instagram at the Queens of Social Work. If you want more information on the topic we discussed today, feel free to check out our show notes or email us at thequeensofsocialwork@gmail.com. We'd really appreciate it if you rate, review, and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.